morning, good afternoon, and good evening. This is the IGO Access to Curative Rights Protection PDP Working Group call on the 17th of December, 2014. On the call today, we have Gary Campbell, Petter Reinforth, George Kiriokos, David Maher, Paul Tattersfield, Jay Chapman, Philip Corwin, Val Sherman, Jim Bykoff, Mason Cole, and Osvaldo Nueva. We have apologies from Lori Schulman. From staff, we have Amy Bivin, Mary Wong, Steve Chan, and myself, Terry Agnew. I would like to remind all participants to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and back over to you, Phil.
Well, thank you, and good morning, afternoon, or evening, whatever it might be for you, and thank you for joining our final call for this working group in the calendar year of 2014. And I appreciate everyone making time to be on here. We're going to use this time period just to review some basic background documents to get more acquainted with their content as they're relevant to our work down the road. And then we can start back up in January with that knowledge base and engage further in this working toward a final report and recommendations. So I believe the document we're going to start with is a 2005 document turned out by the World Intellectual Property Organization, which was their interpretation or report on the actual effect of the Article 6 tier for IGOs. So let me see if that's the... Hold on, I'm just checking something. Okay, so let's go, I guess it's to page 5, because the first three pages are just the content, listing the contents. Well, starting on page... let's see, page 4 of the PDF, which it notes that the in 2005, the Standing Committee on the Law of Trademarks, Industrial Designs, and Geographical Indications met in Geneva and invited members to submit proposals for its future work, et cetera. But now getting on... page 5, legal aspects. And, of course, it notes that the Article 6 tier goes back to 1925, was revised in 1934, and then again in 1958. I was only alive during that final revision, and many of you may not have been. Point number 6 notes that the purpose was to provide a degree of legal protection to et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and then goes on to abbreviations and names of international intergovernmental organizations of which at least one member state is a member of the Paris Union under the 58 revision. So that's the relevant part for us, is the names of international intergovernmental organizations. And point 8 notes that it's also applicable to states that are parties to the Paris Convention, as well as all members of the World Trade Organization, whether or not they're a party to the Paris Convention. So those are the nations, and I don't know, maybe staff knows how many nations are included in those two groups. I suspect it's probably a majority of nations in the world, and certainly industrial organizations, but we can check on the scope. That's where these protections operate. And then moving on to scope of protection, and emblems. Okay, So at page 7 of the PDF, if you'll scroll down, we get to signs of international intergovernmental organizations. We're not really concerned that much with, well, I guess we should note that it applies to armorial bearings, flags, other emblems, abbreviation. And here's abbreviations and names. So that's the key one for us, although, of course, if there was a website trying to mimic an intergovernmental organization which used any of its signs or other emblems, that would be covered as well. And there's a caveat that signs are excluded from the scope of the revision if they're already subject to international agreements in force which are intended to ensure that protection. So that would be if there were separate international legal protection for one of these organizations. So Article 6 tier is subsidiary to other overriding protections if they exist. Okay, and Mary, let me ask you, in this, in Clause 18, the reference to International Bureau, what is the International Bureau? Is that part of WIPO? Do you know?
Phil, I think it refers to WIPO, and, you know, we don't want to go into the whole history of WIPO, but in this particular instance, I think it refers to WIPO, or at least the organ within it that deals with these notifications.
Okay. Okay. So, all right. So I guess the for our purposes here, does the entity, the intergovernmental organization, the IGO, do they have to communicate with WIPO to take advantage of this Article 6 tier protection, or is it self-executing? I'm trying to figure that out from the language.
Phil, was that a question for me?
If anyone else has knowledge on this, wants to chime in, and go ahead, Mary.
Thanks, Phil, and I noticed that George has already noted in the chat that yeah, it's not automatic protection that in our case, the IGOs have to notify WIPO or the International Bureau, and the Bureau will then communicate that to all the member states, following which the member states have 12 months to lodge an objection should they have one to that particular IGO. So, in other words, it is not automatic or self-executing. The IGO has to, in effect, let WIPO and therefore the member states know that it wishes to be protected under 6-tier.
Okay. So that's good. So to understand the 6-tier protection relevant to our work, it's something that needs to be, it's not self-executing, needs to be affirmatively taken advantage of by the IGO through a communication to the International Bureau of WIPO. WIPO, in turn, informs member states of the Paris Convention and also, I assume, members of the World Trade Organization of that IGO's protection, and those members, those member nations have a 12-month period in which to object. I would imagine those objections are few and far between, but it gives individual states some control over whether or not they want to recognize the protection, regardless of whether it's provided under 6-tier. And then in point number 19, this is for permanent entities. In other words, there's no expiration date on the IGO. It's permanent in the sense that there's no, its charter is indefinite in term. And okay, now Number 20, limitation on protections is also very critical, which is the protections of signs of international intergovernmental organizations is limited to cases in which their use or registration as trademarks would suggest a connection with the organization. So, in other words, let's say we've got an IGO. It hasn't registered its name or abbreviations as trademarks. It has communicated its claim for protection under Article 6 tier to the International Bureau, and that in turn has been conveyed out to individual member nations. Those nations are supposed to protect it against trademarks which would suggest a connection with the organization. So there's some subjectivity in the interpretation of that. And then it notes that the second sentence of Article 6 tier provides that countries are not obliged to apply Article 6 tier when the use of names of abbreviations or names of international intergovernmental organizations would not suggest a connection. So, again, it's a subjective judgment. So if someone registers whosomething.com, if it doesn't suggest a connection with the World Health Organization, there's no requirement for a member nation to block the registration of that trademark. So I imagine there's some, it seems to me, and again, I'm going to let George jump in here in a minute, because I know he's knowledgeable, that if, say, someone was to want to register, you know, whoami.whatever with the U.S. As a trademark, with the U.S. Trademark Office, they would not be obliged to block that registration because it would not, on its face, suggest a connection with the World Health Organization. So, in effect, it seems like the trademark authorities and individual nations are performing some kind of subjective screening function in the trademark area. So, to sum up, and then I'm going to let George jump in and perhaps correct me or add to this, it seems that Article 6 tier protection is related to trademarks. It's not the same as a trademark. It does give rise to some obligation of member states to protect against abbreviation by trademark registrations, but the way in which they do that is somewhat subjective. And I'll stop there, and let's hear from George.
George Carrico speaking. I think strictly speaking, the Article 6 protection is supposed to, you know, block the registration of a trademark on, you know, a country's national database if it would conflict in the manner you suggested. You know, obviously you can have trademark registrations that that don't conflict in terms of suggesting similarity to the IGO or to the you know, national emblems or whatever, but obviously we're limiting our discussion here to IGOs. One thing I did want to point out in the language of paragraph 20, and it's also evident in the actual text of the Article 6 tier, is that it says that the second sentence of Article 6 tier provides that countries, let me emphasize the word countries, are not obliged to apply Article 6 tier when the use of or registration of armorial bearings, blah, 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 are not going to suggest a connection between the mark and the organization. The key point, I think, there is that it's the countries that are the ones that are the actors that are supposed to enforce this within their nations, and that goes to, you know, the applicability of, you know, national jurisdiction in terms of how these so-called protections are actually applied, and that goes back to that, you know, U.S. State Department memo and also, you know, the national jurisdiction of the registrant in terms of a domain name. And notice that, to go back a step further, strictly speaking, the Article 6 is about trademark registration. It's not about all possible uses of an acronym or of a mark. You might have a license plate, for example, that matches the acronym of an IGO, you know, a license plate is not a trademark. You might have a stock symbol that might be similar to an IGO's mark. That's not a trademark. Whether their domain name is a trademark or can be used as a trademark is, you know, somewhat of an open question. But strictly speaking, the Article 6 doesn't apply to domain names. So to some extent, we'd be making new law if we apply this to domain names. But, you know, it's not too big of a stretch, but, you know, we should keep that in mind.
Yeah. And let me comment, you know, in my view, there's a personal view, I believe that domain names are either a type or very similar to a type of intellectual property or very similar in that they're a valuable intangible asset, and we're dealing with an ICANN system in which domain names are not I don't think viewed as trademarks, but in which trademark holders are given some ability to access two different arbitration systems if they believe that a particular domain name has infringed their trademark. So that's kind of the context in which we're considering this. Then part two of this memo goes on to legal framework for communications, where the International Bureau is the intermediary between states and the IGOs, and they communicate, they pass on communications. And then number 22 here on page 8 of the PDF is quite relevant in the case of signs of international intergovernmental organizations. And again, remember that signs includes names and abbreviations. Communication to the countries party to the Paris Convention is a prerequisite for obtaining protection under Article 6 tier. So, again, that shows that the IGO, the Article 6 tier protection is not automatically conferred. The IGO has to take steps to communicate, have that communicated to member nations. And although... let's go on to 23. Emblems and signs of states and international IGOs are first communicated to the International Bureau by the competent authority of the country or organization concerned. So the communication be from a country that's established it or the IGO itself. And then the International Bureau then transmits that information to the states party for the Paris Convention and to members of the World Trade Organization. And then, as we know, at least in the case of the U.S., and we, Suzanne Riddell is checking to make sure it's still the position, that the U.S. at least says, okay, we get our Patent and Trademark Office gets notice of your claim to Article 6 tier protection as an IGO. And then I guess I'm making this assumption here. If the IGO believes that the Patent and Trademark Office has made a mistake and allowed a trademark to be registered that infringes upon its Article 6 tier protection, its remedy, according to that 2002 State Department memo, is to file a civil trademark infringement litigation in the courts of the United States. So the remedy is if the trademark authority of a nation does something that the IGO believes is allowed an infringing mark to be trademarked, its remedy is to access the civil courts of the United States, which bears on the sovereign immunity question, but also on the procedures for protection. The next page goes on to transmittal of objections. I'm going to get to you in a second, George. I see your hand up. And again, I don't know how many objections have ever been received, but the key point is number 30. If a state objects, it's not obliged to give any protection to the IGO, which is interesting. And George's hand has gone down. That was up for the previous comment. Okay. Item 31, toward the bottom of page 9, Article 6 tier of the Paris Convention is only applicable in respect of trademarks. And I think that's the point George was making. Doesn't cover license plates, doesn't automatically, I guess for our purposes, it would, we can, you know, I welcome opinion on this. If it's only applicable in respect of trademarks, does that mean that it doesn't affect domain names, or does it, to the extent that national laws protect trademark rights that may be infringed by domains, such as the U.S. Anti-Cybersquatting Protection Act, or that an arbitration system has been established to protect trademarks vis-a-vis domain names. I don't know how to read that. When it says only applicable in respect to trademarks, should we read that as not extending to domain names, or as relevant to domain names insofar as trademarks are protected by various protection regimes, both legislative and arbitration? Anybody have a view on that, on what the meaning of that first sentence of item 31 is? And while that question hangs out there, I'm just going to review the chat room to see what's coming.
Phil, this is Mary. I have a comment.
Yes.
And on your point about the domain name and trademark interface that George also mentioned, I wanted to draw the group's attention back to the summary and work done by subgroup C somewhat earlier in our deliberations in reviewing some of the background material, including the 2001-2002 WIPO2 process documents. And one of the notes from that document that was reported by this subgroup is that in cases not involving the use of domain names as trademarks, it could possibly mean the creation of new international law. So it's, and obviously the recommendation there is somewhat different in terms of the actual process to be established, but it does draw a link between the use of the domain name and the fact that it has to be used as a trademark, which goes back to the wording of Sixtur itself. I don't know if that helps, but I thought it would be useful to mention.
Yes. Yeah, thanks for pointing that out. I'm not sure if it helps me or not. I'm going to have to consider this question, but I think it's a central question for the task of this working group is the extent to which Article 6-tier applies to domain names is obviously a critical factor. And and I'm going to think about it, but not voice an opinion on this. Going on, there's a principle of non-retroactivity starting on page 9, which is basically it doesn't go back in time. It's not retroactive. And then there are additional protection measures, excuse me.
Phil, this is Kathy. I just came online.
Yeah.
And
Hi, Kathy.
So I apologize for jumping in a few seconds late, but I did have something to raise on 31.
Sure.
Okay, which is, and this is a really interesting discussion. So I read 31 a little differently. I mean, it's really narrow what this applies to, because it seems like 31 is telling us that the Sixtur, Article Sixtur of the Paris Convention, applies to trademarks, but not necessarily service marks. So forget about the rest of the world. Forget about domain names. Forget about license plates. Forget about flags. It may not apply to service marks. It probably does, but it's a very 31 is very, very narrow.
Well, guys, the second sentence there says the provision may be applied analogously to service marks, but that Paris Convention does not establish an international obligation to do so. In other words, a member state to the Paris Convention or the WTO may, at its option, choose to apply it to service marks, but is not required to do so by the Paris Convention. That's how I read that.
At least not in this paragraph. Right.
Yeah.
So that seems to imply that the rest of the universe, at least as viewed from this paragraph, is excluded. Is you know, if we're not even including service marks, forget everything else. Thanks.
Right. Right.
Can I jump in?
Yes, George.
If you look at paragraph 32, though, it actually says it does apply to service marks as well. It does arise from Article 16 of the trademark theory, law treaty. So just look down from paragraph 30.
Right. So contracting parties, who are the contracting parties?
Phil, this is Mary. I've just typed in the chat. My understanding is that there was a trademark law treaty in 94, I think it was. So as I typed in the chat, if a country is a member of Paris or the WTO, and so they're obligated to signature, if they're also a member of the trademark law treaty or contracted to the trademark law treaty, then they would extend the signature protection, if any, to service marks. So it's possible that for countries that are not members of the trademark law treaty, that their national obligations would not extend to service marks, but that would not be the case if a country is also a member of the trademark law treaty.
Right, right. Well, I suppose at some point in our work we should, I suspect that the when you put together the nations that are either signatories to the Paris Convention or members of the World Trade Organization, I think it's probably the majority of nations in the world, but it would be good at some point to have access to those lists just to check that assumption against the facts. But let's presume for right now that it's, again, my supposition is that most developed and industrialized nations are in one or both of those camps. Okay, I'm just skimming through the non-retroactivity. Item 35, in respect to signs of international IGOs, the date on which an act of the Paris Convention providing for their protection, the 1958 Lisbon Act or the 1967 Stockholm Act, entered into force in the country concerned, is to be taken into account. So, and then when you read further, it seems to say that if someone acquired, the trademark in WHO, you know, to stand for, wholesale health organization in a nation before it signed either one of those acts, that the World Health Organization protection would not exist in that nation because the mark was registered before Article 6 tier came in effect. But that's, again, an option for the country. They're free not to grant protection, but I guess also they would be free to do it. And George has provided us with a list of when countries... George, is that a list... which treaty is that? George, could you just speak up? You've listed a whole nation... Yeah, which treaty those nations signed?
That was the 1994 treaty that Mary had mentioned earlier that applied to service marks. So if you click on the link, it says that there's 51 signatories, so 50 states and
right.
IGO have signed it. The United States has signed it, United Kingdom, so most of the big countries. I don't see Canada on the list, though.
Okay, so... Yeah. Okay. So for most nations, this goes back about 20 years. The range of protection, and then additional protection measures. On item 36. I note the second sentence, the communication of signs of IGOs pursuant to Article 6 tier, thus only has effects on marks from the day of entry into force of the relevant act of the Paris Convention, irrespective of whether the mark in question was registered more than 2 months after receipt of the communication, et cetera. So this is all very technical, but I'm not sure we need to. I don't know how that would apply if this is relevant to UDRP or URS, if there'd been any look at the nation of the registrant and whether Article 6 tier protection exists. That's an interesting question. Anyone have any thoughts on that one?
George Kirikos here. I just wanted to point out the language in paragraph 36. It also refers to that an obligation for countries to grant protection. So it's always, you know, the countries that are doing the enforcement
mechanism,
and the countries that have the obligation to protect. And so when we talk about jurisdiction and immunities and stuff, and even standing to bring an action, one of the suggestions I had made in the emails is that conceivably you could give standing to the nation, like the federal government of Canada or the federal government of the United States, to act in place of the IGO to bring the UDRP. So that's that would be consistent, I believe, with the language of the treaty.
Okay. All right. Well, again, all of this is talking about protection against the unauthorized registration of the names or abbreviations as trademarks in a particular nation. So it only applies if the nation is a signatory to the convention or a member of the WTO, and the trademark in question was not registered prior to its entry into one of these relevant conventions. So we're going to have to think about how, if at all, that applies to domains where there's no intervening authority, screening domains before they're registered, as there would be something like the PTO in the U.S. and blocking registrations of marks that would suggest an association with the IGO. Okay, there's also top of page 9, marks contrary to morality or public order can be denied registration or invalidated at a national level. In particular, where there is such a nature as to deceive the public. Well, that's morality and public order are not general trademark considerations, but deceiving the public is directly related to the purpose of trademark, which is to provide the public with an easy way to identify a good or service with its origins. All right. Next is administrative aspects. I'm going to skip over that one now. Communications procedures. This is all about. Let's go down middle of page 12, item 46. This is under procedure to be followed by international intergovernmental organizations. It requested through the intermediary of the International Bureau of YPO. Informally, it transmits documentation concerning its legal status and a list of its member states, including its statute or charter, other than for UN agencies. The International Bureau examines all that. But that's a prima facie determination, since ultimate authority remains with the states party to the Paris Convention or members of the WTO. Okay, there's a pre-clearance request in 48. There's other technical aspects in 49, 600 copies. I've never seen a 600 copy requirement prior. It discusses the objection procedure, and then at the top of page 12 of the document, page 13 of the PDF, there's the agreement between WIPO and the WTO. Then there's statistical information, but that dates back to 2005, so it's somewhat old. It's not current, but we could easily check with WIPO for the current statistical information in this regard. Then middle of page 13 of the document refers to the Article 6-tier database, which is maintained by WIPO International Bureau. And then we get a whole lot of footnotes after that and an annex with the text of Article 6-tier. So I hope I haven't been boring everybody, but I thought it would be, even though this document's in our database at the website for this working group, I thought it'd be useful the holiday break to just delve into some detail to understand precisely both the scope and the limitations on Article 6-tier protection, since we're being asked to consider whether those protections should be specially noted in the UDFP or URS, or whether we should create a new curative rights process to protect them in the domain name context. I think what we've found by in this review is that they are related to trademark rights, but not the same, that they apply in nations that have signed the Paris Convention or are members of the World Trade Organization, that the IGO has to take affirmative steps to get the protection in those nations through communication to the International Bureau of WIPO, that individual nations are free to object and to not protect a particular IGO within its nations. There's some, I guess the debatable point is the whether the provision says that this only applies to trademarks and service marks, whether that would mean that it these protections should be observed in the domain name system because it gives protection to trademarks, or whether it shouldn't be taken into account because domain names are not the same as trademarks. And this is mostly a scheme for preventing the registration of trademarks, which are identical to IGO full names or abbreviations, or which suggest a connection that would mislead the public. So I'm going to stop there. And, you know, I think this is all good stuff for us to think about, but does anyone else have thoughts on what the implications are of this WIPO memo to the work that remains before us? I'm not hearing anything or seeing any hands, in which case I'll assume that the summary I just gave is where we're at right now, but we're going to, when we come back in the new year, I think we're going to have to grapple with the central question. Certainly, I think the GAC and the GNSO Council, by implication, think there's some obligation here to give credence to these Article 6-tier rights in the domain name system, but that's not determinative for our purposes. We're going to have to engage on that central question when we come back in the new year. I'm going to move on to the other document unless folks have comments here. And
I've got one comment.
George, here,
I recognize your voice. You're never in the chat room, but I recognize your voice.
Thank you. I just want to say that I listened to a lot of the comments that were made. I think it's good historical points. But I think what will be interesting is to see the reaction of GAC and also the IGOs, if any, because, you know, these are points that they should be well aware of, especially the IGOs, since in the last PDP, They mentioned a number of these points in their presentations about why they needed the relief. And, you know, you would think that international governmental organizations would be able to come up with, you know, some rejoinder on these points if they care enough about this. So I think, you know, before anybody does a huge amount of work on this, we ought to see what kind of responses we get, because we're giving them the rest of the month of December, and come January, I would think if we don't have any responses, that's going to be a very large statement by itself.
Yeah, and Mary, remind me, I think we gave them till pretty late in January to respond to that letter we just sent. Isn't that correct?
Yes, Phil, for the SOs, ACs, and the stakeholder groups, we set 23rd of January. I think everyone will recall also that we did send specific questions not just to the GAC but to the IGOs, and my understanding is that they are looking at the questions. I have no indication as of yet whether and when they will come back, but from what I can tell, and Mason may be able to jump in here, the GAC and the IGOs have received our questions quite graciously, and hopefully they will come back in January or at least by Singapore so that we can move forward in our work.
Okay. Yeah, thank you, Mary. Yeah, so we won't know the full range of responses till the third week of January, which is either 2 or 3 weeks before our face-to-face in Singapore and loss of private reporting on where we're at to the GNSO Council when we're in Singapore, and we may have other interactions there as well. We're checking on that. But, yeah, it's going to be very telling now. If they, they have an opportunity to respond, and if we don't get any feedback, that says something in itself. But let's not try to predetermine the outcome. We'll also see how they react to our initial decision to say we don't need to do anything special for INGOs. They have no special rights and are free to get trademarks and do it the same way as any other complainant.
It was not my intention to say we should just disregard. What I'm suggesting is that before we undertake huge amounts of further research and reports on behalf of trying to find a way to protect the IGOs, it seems to me that we want to try to get some response back saying that they indeed want us to do that and give us some of the answers to the questions that have been raised, because I can just see us spending huge amounts of time and then not getting satisfactory answers or not getting any answers. And I think it would be, a total waste of everybody's time.
Yeah, that, I agree, Jim. You know, we need to see what they come back with. And, the basis for any amendment, in my view, I don't want to speak for the group. In my personal view, the basis for any amendment to the UDIP or URS, much less the creation of a new ERP, would have to be standing based upon the protection conferred by Article 6 here. And as we've seen, it's fairly narrow protection, and it's not obligatory on states. They can refuse to do it, and it's not self-executing. It requires IGOs to take affirmative steps to get that protection from the nation states that are willing to provide it and not object to it. So that's the nature of the rights conferred by Article 6 tier on IGOs. That would have to be the basis for any special amendment or new CRP in terms of standing. I think, George, you wanted to say something further?
I just want to conclude that, I think the two big takeaways are that Article 6 chair is strictly intended to apply as a blocking mechanism for registration of trademarks and wasn't really intended to apply to, you know, any other kinds of marks per se. And then the other big takeaway, but in some sense, you know, the IGOs can argue that they're quasi-trademarks in the sense that, you know, if they had actually a trademark, it would act in the same manner, because if they had a registered trademark, it would, in effect, block the trademark, a conflicting trademark for that same usage. So, but thing is, nothing prevents the IGOs from going through the hoops of actually registering a trademark. And as I've pointed out in some of the cases, you know, we have examples where they actually have done that. They've filed trademarks and enforced them through the UDRP. The second point that I want to make is if you actually look at Annex 1, which is the full text of the Article 6 TIR, repeatedly it says, you know, that it's the countries that refute, that, you know, that agree to do this. You know, it says, for example, in 1A, the countries of the Union agree to refuse or to invalidate the registration by appropriate measures. And then 1C, it says, no country of the Union shall be required. So it's always left to the countries. So I think that argues for the jurisdiction of the national courts and not some international tribunal, because it's always subject to the national laws of each of the member states.
Right, right. To me, that, you know, let's, again, the question that raises in my mind is, let's say, just hypothetically, it was a decision of this working group to say that an IGO's communication to the International Bureau of its rights under Article 6-2 should be regarded as a basis for standing to be a complainant in a UDRP or URS, that it was not necessary to register a trademark in a particular nation. That's just a hypothetical. I'm not suggesting we're going to come out that way, but just it's a thought experiment. Let's say a domain name was registered by someone residing in a nation that had objected, an individual or a company had registered a domain name and it was domiciled in a nation that had objected to protection of that particular IGO name. Would that IGO be protected against that domain registrant, since they would not be protected against the registration of that domain name as a trademark in that nation? So I hope that doesn't complicate things too much, but I think it illustrates some of the technicalities we may have to deal with here. All right, so we're at 12:52. We have 8 minutes left. I don't know that and thank you, George and Kathy, for chiming in that's a useful hypothetical. We're not really going to have time to go through this staff document in the remaining 8 minutes, but I wanted to bring it to everybody's attention. It's in the it's at the workspace. You also now have it as a separate attachment to the staff email sent out this morning. I'd urge everyone to look at this. I haven't fully reviewed it yet. It's something that was developed by ICANN staff. Almost 10 years ago. It's from 2007. I don't know. Yeah, the other document. So this is a 7-year-old document. It wasn't a working group. It's a staff document that suggested what a separate DRP might look like for IGOs. Obviously, I don't know the full history, Mary, of whatever happened to this report after it was submitted by staff, but clearly it was never implemented. But I'd suggest everybody, you know, use the holidays if you have a few minutes to read this over, and we can perhaps start in the new year with some discussion of this document and to the extent to which it has any bearing on our consideration of these issues, whether we accept any of it or don't accept what's in there. So at 12:54, with 6 minutes left, I'm going to open it up if anyone has anything they want to say at this point to chime in. And if not, I think I hope everyone found this a useful, different from our usual procedure, just an in-depth review of a critical document so that we could better collectively consider and understand the exact nature, the scope, and the limitations on Article 6 tier protections. I see folks leaving the chat room, so I'm going to exercise my prerogative at 12:55, 5 minutes early, to adjourn the meeting with a reminder that we have a call on the first Wednesday in January 2015. And I wish everyone very happy holidays and very healthy and prosperous new year. And think about the questions raised today and talk to you all in 2015.